Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for a wonderful Cormac McCarthy book to help me. Our two Cormacian experts, Ian, two high school English teachers, Ian and Joe.
I'm Joe Holshue. I don't know if I have a wonderful Cormac McCarthy book, but I have a very bleak Cormac McCarthy book, which I think is one of his, it's one of his things. Nick, I'm of course talking about The Road, the 2006 novel, the 2007 Pulitzer Prize winner by Cormac McCarthy, the post-apocalyptic The Road.
Wow, that was quite the introduction. You had made sure you got the Pulitzer in there, didn't you? There, Joe.
Yeah. Ian, does your author have a Pulitzer Prize?
My author does. He hasn't won the Nobel yet, and I think I would like to talk yet. About...
Oh, shoot. Hey, Joe, does your author, has he won the Nobel Prize?
My author has not yet won the Nobel Prize, and he better do it soon, because I don't think you can win it posthumously. This is something we've talked about before. And Nick, spoiler, he's really old. Like Cormac
McCarthy's pretty old.
He's pretty old.
He's pretty old. I'm just so you guys know, I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, if you're looking for a book by His Royal Excellency Cormac McCarthy, I think you should read All the Pretty Horses, published in 1992 by the legendary American publishing house, Alfred A. Knopf.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
I've read both of these books.
Wait, so is that true?
Yeah, that's fucking true.
Are you serious?
Read All the Pretty Horses?
Don't say it like that, Joe.
Why do you have to say it like that? It's like, just, I feel when like, you say it like that, it makes it sound so rude.
It makes it sound like,
yeah, no, I did read like it.
The deepest of deep cuts.
I feel like The Road is The Road was pretty popular when it came out. So, but I feel like All the Pretty Horses, I guess it also was popular when it came out, but it also came out when Nick was like 3 years old.
Yes, but it came out, Joe, when you were like 3 years old advanced. Or something.
I was like eight.
Recounted.
We're like the same age, basically. Like 3 years older than me. Yeah, and to be fair, I didn't read it. Audible read it to me.
You know, it's been a while, but I think it's time for us to come back to Audible. Audible, we know you're listening.
Dear
we know
Audible.
You monitor this. And we just want to say, we don't need your money. We don't need your sponsorship, but we desperately want it. So please.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good.
But we would take it. We would take your money.
We would like it.
We would love it. I would say we would love it.
I would like to stop recommending that people listen to books on the YouTube fan recordings. I know it's been suggested here before.
That's what you do every week. That's like how you sign off.
Maybe we should start a new segment where if I have listened to the book on Audible, I'll kind of give a review.
Oh,
a one-star review.
Well, no, any stars.
That just sounds like you're taking our jobs.
No. Just the Audible audio experience.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, I just want to give my two cents, not on the story, but on the experience.
Okay.
Oh. Great.
Yeah, so the author, the reading, etc.
Great. Okay.
So
I'm waiting. I'm
both
ready.
Of these are good. Good audio.
Fantastic.
And there you have it, folks. That's been the segment. Thanks for tuning in to Nick Tells You in One Sentence How the Audible Book Is.
Yeah, good. Really good. Pretty good.
Nick, can we please
move on?
Can we please have... No, can we please have like a theme song for that segment?
Just a huge buildup.
It would be amazing if the theme song could be like 30 to 45 seconds long.
I love it. Please. That'd be amazing.
Okay, so the person who does the Audible book for... He definitely does The Road.
Mm-hmm.
Is Tom... Nah, I'm not going to say this last
Tom
name
Selleck.
Right. Tom Selleck.
Tom Waits?
Ooh, I would listen to that so hard. Tom Waits.
Tom
Schlitch.
I'm going to spell this and then you guys say how it is. Say how you think it's pronounced.
I want to do it before Ian. I want to do it before Ian.
Okay, Joe can go first.
Joe first.
S T E C H C H. No, hold on.
Yep.
It's hard to even spell out, let alone pronounce. S T E C H S C H U L T E. Stechel?
Oh, that is. Yes, Stechel. Of course.
Wow.
That is, of course, Stitchy Schilt.
You got to check him out. Tom Stitchy Schilt. Ian, Joe got to go first. Did you want to add something?
Yeah. At all? McCarthy.
McCarthy, yeah. McCarthy. Okay, so let's move on. great first segment.
Yep. It's a good one. It's a keeper for sure.
Nick's
keeper.
Audible audio reviews. Come back next week.
I do think, okay, just a really real fast. I do think it's super interesting the different forms that audiobooks can take. We talked in perhaps a previous week or perhaps a week in the future, I'm not sure which, about Ender's Game and doing further research on Ender's Game, what they call Oppo research, to just totally wipe the floor with Joe. I discovered that the audiobook of Ender's Game is actually an audio play. And some books get this full-on audio play treatment. Some of them get just very energetic audiobook readers, like when I believe it was Harlan Ellison read The Wizard of Earthsea and screamed most of it.
Screamed The Wizard of Earthsea.
And some are just like kind of straightforward. So it's super fascinating how, like, when you sign up for an audio book, you might get a variety of experiences.
Yeah, there's not really a set format. And when I think of audiobooks that I've really, really loved in the past, like when I think of like his Dark Materials trilogy, right? Like that is always a full cast recording and it's outstanding. Mm. It really is an audio play.
On that note, gentlemen, do you want to give me your 30-second plots here? Joe, would you like to go first this week?
I have already started. The Road is a post-apocalyptic novel. The book details the journey of a father and his young son over a period of several months as they travel across a landscape blasted by an unspecified cataclysm that has destroyed most of civilization and, in the intervening years, almost all life on Earth. Along the way, they encounter streams with no fish, roving bands of cannibals, cellars full of people being harvested for their meat. The novel was awarded the 2007 Pulitzer Prize, Ian, for fiction, and is mandatory reading for the developers of both the Fallout series and The Last of Us.
Wow. That was very good, Joe. I didn't get the characters' names, though. Can you share those with us?
They actually don't have names. It's the man and the boy. The man and the boy.
That's the early... the first version that came out, he hadn't decided on their names. eventually he decided to name the man
Tom Selleck.
Decided to name the man Larry and the boy was named Tom Selleck. So
yeah, Larry Stitchy Shoot.
Ian, I believe it's your turn.
Okay.
What are you going to tell us in 30 seconds?
John Grady Cole fancies himself a cowboy. Confronted with the possibility of moving into city life, he instead lights out for Mexico in the open range. But out there in the Sierras and Haciendas and Rios, John Grady discovers that the cowboy lifestyle is harder and more dangerous than he had imagined. Love, betrayal, prison stabbings, and an epic quest to find and return a massive horse make Cormac McCarthy's novel All the Pretty Horses surprisingly powerful.
I think it sounds... It really digs me out of it when it sounds like you guys read off the back of a book cover.
Well, you know what?
It sounds like you're really phoning it in.
Product of your scriptures.
You're authoritarianism.
Yeah. I guess I didn't think it was going to turn into you guys reading something, but I should have known better. I should have known that you'd meticulously plan out those 30 seconds.
So I've actually stopped timing myself on these. Nick, how close are we to actually 30 seconds? I bet it's pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. Yeah, it's pretty close. And I don't believe you. I think you absolutely planned these out.
Ian, when you say a massive horse, do you mean a physically large horse?
Yes.
I don't remember that.
It's like the horse just keeps cropping up, no pun intended, throughout the course of the book. And it gets stolen a whole bunch. And it's kind of like one of these through lines throughout the course of the text.
All this large horse talk has got me really excited for this book. Why don't you kick it off this week?
I would like to play a game to start us off. So I don't really know what this game is called. Joe and I have tried to we batted around ideas about what it should be called. Okay. We've settled on something around the along the lines of Corm Facts Make a Facty.
yeah, I have Corm Facts McCarthy, but I like Corm Facts.
Before we go on, can we, with this game that I'm very excited to play, can we just go over the ones that didn't make it? The names, I mean?
Actually, yes. I was going to call it Corm Facts McOneUp because we're trying to one-up each other, but that doesn't really work that well. So that's the only one
terrible.
That didn't make it.
Just terrible.
I know, right? It's dreadful.
And my first game was, these are the facts about Cormac McCarthy is what I entitled it. It was full sentence.
So what's the name of this segment?
This is a game called Corm Facts McFacty.
Good.
And the way this works is Joe and I trade off. Since this guy is very secretive, but also there are a lot of weird facts out there about him. Like a lot of his life is very interesting and odd. Joe and I will trade off and the last person to run out of facts, I guess, wins. The last person to have facts.
Sure, wins.
And Nick, your role is to be judge. So if we repeat a fact, you have to call that out. And also, Nick, if you don't like one of our facts and you think it's not like worthy of the game, you can also cancel a fact and we have to come up with a new
judge
one.
Judge the merit of the facts.
Oh, I can do that.
Similar to your Audible review. Your Audible review.
Hey guys. Yeah. Hey guys.
Yep.
I'm Mick loving this.
he's gotten into copyright infringement. This is concerning. Okay. Right. Joe, would you like to go first or shall I?
I will go first. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
all right. So Cormac McCarthy dropped out of college in 1951, thereabouts, and was stationed in Alaska in the military. At that point, he became a reader of books. He claims that is the first time in his life that he read books. It was when he was 20 years old in Alaska.
Any book?
That is what he claims.
Like, kind of like for fun, in a focused way, yes.
In a focused way, that's right.
Like, he probably read Sea Spot Run when he was a kid, but really, this is when he... I can actually build on that fact. While he was in the Air Force in Alaska, he ran a radio show, and that was kind of his brush with the public, and ever since that point, he has been very much out of the public eye.
Hmm. Very nice. See, I feel like this isn't that crazy because I think
he's leading with the easy ones. We got some really good ones. Go ahead, Joe. Your turn.
That's right.
All right. So you have better ones. Okay, good.
His name is not Cormac. At least it was not initially Cormac. His name was initially Charlie McCarthy, but he changed it because there was a famous ventriloquist dummy named Charlie McCarthy when he was young that he didn't want to be confused with.
I thought you were going to say it was Joseph McCarthy.
Didn't want to be confused with Joe McCarthy. I've got a fact that keys off of that one. Cormac McCarthy is descended from Cormac McCarthy, who is the Irish king who found and named the Blarney Stone.
What is the Blarney Stone?
You don't know what the Blarney Stone is. What
you
is your problem?
No.
You uncultured Philistine.
Blarney Stone. The fuck is that?
The Blarney Stone is the stone, the stone that if you kiss it, it's in a castle in Ireland, and if you bend down over the rails, kind of launching your body out over the moat of the castle, and you kiss the stone, you'll supposedly get the gift of the gab.
This is so stupid. These photos of people. Have you ever seen this?
No,
it's ridiculous.
You gotta kiss it.
Oh yes.
Have either of you kissed this stone?
No, ew. It's probably got like all kinds of lip fungus all over it.
Oh my goodness.
I have not kissed this stone, but on Wall Street, there's a bull. Have you seen the bull on Wall Street?
Yeah, you kiss its testicles.
And you kiss its testicles. I have kissed that bull's testicles.
That's somehow much, much worse.
So similar. What do you get the gift of when you do that, Joe?
Oh, you get, no.
Oh,
chlamydia. okay.
Cormac McCarthy is descended from Cormac McCarthy, the Irish king who found and named the Blarney Stone. Your turn, Joe.
Yeah. All right. Nick, Cormac McCarthy believes that you cannot write about a place without visiting that place. So as a result, he's traveled a tremendous amount in his lifetime. Everywhere he goes, he carries a 100-watt light bulb with him in his bag so that he always has enough light to read.
That's crazy.
I'm just going to jump in and say that sounds like Apocrypha. That does not sound true.
It's on his Wikipedia page. I could follow the footnote if I wanted.
He rented a pig farm in the 1960s to live on, and it cost him $50 a month.
That's a shit fact.
I know it is.
I've got one to build on that, Nick. He lived throughout his life. He committed to being a writer. Like, he committed to never taking a job, right? So as a result, he often lived in total poverty. Those are his words. He lived in houses without running water. He and his wife would bathe in the lake. And his first wife said that every once in a while, somebody would call up and offer him like $2,000 to speak at a university. And he would refuse the speaking assignment, the speaking gig, because he said, "Everything I have to say is on the page." His wife later left him.
Yeah, I wonder why.
when he got money from his novel, All the Pretty Horses.
Yeah. Yes.
When he got his money for this, what he did was he went out and he bought himself a new pickup truck.
I did not have that one. Nick, in 1981, he won a MacArthur Fellowship, which is about $281,000 at the time, right? He immediately left his wife.
That's not funny. That's a fact.
That's a fact.
This is good.
I've got one. He gave his first interview after 27 years after his first book was published.
These aren't good facts at all.
I disagree. He gave that first interview to Oprah Winfrey, of all people. Is that the one you're talking about, Ian?
No, that was actually a later interview.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. His first televised interview was with Oprah Winfrey to promote the 2007's The Road, which is, of course, the book that I brought today. And it was because you can't be a member of Oprah's book club. You can't be an Oprah's book club selection if you don't go on the show and promote your book. Oof. His first televised interview.
Oh, that's just printed money right there. I think we got to get on Oprah's book club.
Wait, isn't every week a book club?
Hang on. Are we taking our book, Too Many Butlers, to Oprah's book club? Is that the deal?
It's been so long since we recorded. I only vaguely remember our book, Too Many Butlers.
Well, we didn't name it, so that's new.
No, but I do like the title. We definitely named it Too Many Butlers.
Really?
Or I did, and you guys said nothing, so I just assumed that was...
Maybe we heard you. Too Many Butlers. Now, is that like T-W-O, or is that the sequel, or is it T-O-O? Like, Too Many Butlers? To be... Maybe like there's literally two butlers, like a sidekick?
I think the first one has to be just normal Too Many Butlers, and then the inevitable sequel is
Too Many.
Just a numeral too many butlers.
Yes, yes, like Two Live Crew, and then after that, we have to choose that? Whether we're going to put the numeral 3 somewhere in it, like Too Many Butlers, but the E in Butler is a 3,
or
if we're just going to go all in and say Three Many Butlers.
I like Three Many Butlers for 3, and then for the fourth book, Too Many Butlers :2.
For the fourth book, that's confusing.
So four that's butlers like the fast in that and the, one.
That's like the Fast too and the Furious conventions.
Too many two butlers. It's been a long day of teaching, but I'm laughing way too hard at that.
Fuck you guys. On our next recording, I'm gonna bring a passage. I'm gonna get this ball rolling. Hey, do you guys have any more facts? I thought that segment felt a little light. Little light.
I should have known.
We'll bulk it up in post, I guess. Fuck assholes. Ian, do you want to please tell us about your horses?
I'll tell you about every single one of my pretty horses.
Can I tell you what I knew about this book going in?
Yeah, please do. I would love that.
One of my favorite movies is No Country for Old Men.
Yes.
And I was talking to a friend, and he said, "Oh, you got to read The Road." So that's how I got into Cormac. But after I read The Road, I wanted to read more because it was fucking awesome. And I'm like, all the pretty horses, all right, and this is supposed to be one of his best books. And I pick it up and we start reading, and it's about horses.
I didn't think it would be about horses.
some serious horse action like in this book.
And then the horses, it's like page one, he's talking about horses, and he doesn't stop all the way through is about horses. So Right. Hats off. He's really a direct writer.
Yeah, it does what it says on the tin.
Okay, so before I start talking about my book, I want to read a quote. I read a really, really good article about kind of McCarthy's work as a whole, but this book in particular. And all of his works, all of his books, except for the Road, are set in the past. And the one line that stood out to me from this article was the claim, McCarthy's work is magnificently oblivious to modern industrial and technological society. So this is like, he just doesn't, he knows he lives in the world. He lives in the world and he's aware of this, and he knows that people in today's world read his books, but he doesn't care. He just refuses to write about today's world. It's either the history, it's either the past, or it's the future in one case.
Yeah. That's cool.
There's kind of a lack of technology, right? Like when you read his books, I don't have a vast knowledge of like his catalog.
Yeah,
but
I mean, in All the Pretty Horses, I mean, I guess you could say a horse is a piece of technology.
That's right. It's one of my favorite pieces of technology.
It's a tool you use to complete stuff. But in this book, like it's set in 1949. There are trucks. There is like there is automobile technology, but it's like what he does is he doesn't make this very much like a late 1940s book. It's not like very obviously, you know, like references to music and culture and stuff. It's very much like a dude goes out into the wilderness and just experiences the stuff that happens to him south of the Mexican border. So
it gives his books such like a timeless feeling,
yes.
Right? Like it really they feel like classics when you read them.
Right. Yeah. When I first read All the Pretty Horses, I didn't know it was set in 49 either. I just missed that or I wasn't aware of it. And I got through it and I was like, whoa, there's a truck here at the end. What's that truck doing? It's the kind of book that could take place in like the early 1800s or 1949. So this is the first book of the Border Trilogy, which is a trilogy of books that McCarthy wrote kind of around the same time. I believe it was 92, 94, and 96 they were published. The other two are called The Crossing and Cities of the Plain. So, sorry, the second one is called The Crossing. The third is called Cities of the Plain. And so these are not the same kind of trilogy as, say, Lord of the Rings. They're more... There aren't so many through lines. You don't have like characters progressing, the same characters showing up in all three books. But they're similar in terms of their time period, in terms of some of their motifs and ideas. I mentioned the Lord of the Rings, and if you guys don't mind, I'll give you a Hobbit fact. Is that cool?
Fantastic.
Yes, that's cool.
Oh, great. I'm glad. So here's my Hobbit fact. Speaking of trilogies, our good friend J.R.R. Tolkien originally wanted the Lord of the Rings to be printed in a single volume. With six books in that volume.
That but the publisher said,
that would be
way too thick. No, no, no. And it was published in three volumes.
That couldn't even fit on shelves.
That was a good call.
There have been some big books, Nick. I think it probably would have fit, but...
Maybe.
Maybe.
We'll never know.
Who knows? No way to know. There's no way for anyone to ever know. So
maybe a really small font.
I'm going to tell you a couple more things about this book, and then I'll tell you why you should read it, okay? Here's one. This book is a buildings roman.
Oh, fuck. Nick, we know what that is. Nick, what's a buildings roman?
Fuck.
it's time for another segment.
I'll humiliate Nick.
as teachers, we actually call that a formative assessment.
I was told there'd be no tests. Oh, shit. Okay, let me remember. It's
One second. I'm going to give you a clue. Last time we asked you what a bullied roman was, you said you responded with the definition.
Coming of age.
Oh, Nick!
There we go.
Well done,
Nick.
He
may have Googled that, Joe. I don't care. He got it right. Well done.
Well done, Nick.
Listen, we've talked about some other buildings romans on this podcast, so there we go. This book is notably less miserable and terrible than many of McCarthy's other works.
Yeah, especially The Road.
Though there is the book which, one of the books which directly preceded this one is called Blood Meridian, which is perhaps McCarthy's best work. It's thick and it's hard. Oh boy. It's been called, Blood Meridian has been called like the most
erotic
book
ever written.
Wait, what's that?
I heard what Nick said. Nick said erotic. Ian, I didn't hear what you said. Can you repeat that?
It's been called, Blood Meridian has been called the most violent book ever written. Like,
wow.
Number of deaths per page, and like the care that McCarthy takes describing the deaths in Blood Meridian is just incredible. It's just, I read that. I first read that when I was visiting Reno, Nevada, where I live now. And I was just, it's like this bleak vision of violence and lawlessness in the West. And here I am, like, going out to the West, maybe to live here for the next 5+ years. Like, okay, what am I getting myself in for? But this book,
and it's the most violent book ever written, but I also frequently hear it described not only as like his magnum opus, like the crowning achievement of his life, but I also have heard it described as the great American novel.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah, it's incredible. It's powerful. It's difficult. I can't say I recommend it because it's such an unpleasant read, but it's so good too.
And I think so many people start with it. Like, I think people are like, well, I want to read his best book. I'm going to read Blood Meridian. And then they go, well, they hit a wall.
I actually think All the Pretty Horses is a really good start because, as I say, it's not so miserable and it's not so grim and terrible. It did win the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award, which sounds like kind of a Walmart version, but apparently is pretty prestigious. We always like to make movie connections. This is one where I maybe wouldn't want to make the movie connection because it was made into a critically panned movie starring Matt Damon and Penelope Cruz. Directed by Billy Bob Thornton.
Here's
the thing, it's really the history of this is really interesting. The movie was panned. Apparently Harvey Weinstein, he who shall not be named, was mad at Billy Bob Thornton for something. And so Weinstein demanded that when they delivered the final cut, which was like 3+ hours long, Weinstein said, cut it down and make it more fun. And so they cut it because he had this grudge against Billy Bob Thornton. And so it ends up being kind of not very, I haven't seen it. Apparently it's just kind of mediocre.
I mean, it's got a 32 on Rotten Tomatoes. So
that's worse than mediocre.
That's way worse than mediocre.
Mediocre is like what? 60, 70%?
I would say mediocre is between like 30 and 60.
No way. It's not 30.
No, it's the middle of the road. I would say
good. Yeah, that's middle of the road, but there's also inflation. Like there's ratings inflation.
Wait, well, wow. What are you talking about?
Like, I mean, you know what ratings inflation is.
Are you going all Rotten Tomatoes conspiracy theorist on this?
Guys, no, it's like a one-star review.
Yes, please.
All the Pretty Horses.
Please. Is this a one-star review of some Pretty Horses or of the book?
This is All the Pretty Horses, the movie. One star by Vicky. Vicky said, one star. We ordered this movie and it will not play. One star. Does not play.
Ooh, Ian, any responses?
Have you tried turning it off and on again?
I can comment.
Oh no.
We tried turning it off and on again.
Good stuff.
Okay, well, I'll see what she says.
Yeah, let's wait for Vicky's
response.
We'll
check back in throughout the show.
I will let you know what Vicky said. You can just publicly comment. That is good to know. Let's move on.
Shocking.
What is the book about, Ian?
So it's about this young man, John Grady Cole. He kind of grows up on a ranch, and then he kind of faces the possibility of having to become citified, become a city boy. And he decides instead he's just going to run away. Kind of like the classic thing where you run away from home when you're a kid, but he actually
like
does
Fievel it. Goes West.
Yes, it's exactly like it. And,
okay,
and so he
goes,
does.
He runs away. Yes.
He runs away and he gets into all kinds of like extremely life-threatening shenanigans almost immediately. So they meet this guy named this young man named Jimmy Blevins. And Jimmy Blevins is a fellow who looks to be quite young, like he's a boy, but he says he's way older than that. And he has this huge horse, which he says is his, but
as we've established,
it's an enormous clear horse. If it's his or not. So anyway,
I always thought that Blevins sounded like such a fake name, like he made it up.
Yeah, yep. That sounds super fake.
Yeah, I mean, like we never really know anything.
Yeah, is it possible that the character did make it up? Because did he know him before?
Did he know him?
Yeah.
No. This is a guy
kind of meets him along his journey, right?
Yep, just bump into him, and they have all kinds of like I say, dangerous adventures. Things get stolen. They get in fights. They end up at a hacienda, and the main character John Grady falls in love with the boss's daughter, and they have this really cool bittersweet romance, which I'll talk about later if I have time. And I really I'm not going to spoil it because of our rules, but the story just kind of meanders along behind. It's a bad word. I shouldn't say meanders. It tracks. It gallops. Ooh, here we go.
Gallops along.
Trot.
No, that's making it worse. Also, trots has plenty of bad connotations.
What about Mick gallops?
All the pretty horses Mick gallops along.
Stupid.
yes, as is much of the show. To follow him through all of his adventures and to watch him growing up and kind of like he discovers that real life is more romantic than he had previously imagined. But it's not sort of a rosy romance. It's a romance tinged with, I mean, when I say romance, I don't mean like love. I mean like sweeping grand vistas of sunsets and dramatic shootouts under the stars and all the story sort of tracks John Grady as he realizes that the world is both more wonderful and more complex and terrible than he previously imagined. And I really don't want to go into more detail than that because the story itself and the things that happen in this story are incredible, which isn't always the case with Cormac McCarthy books. Like the stories are not always the draw in McCarthy. Mm. I would say.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Yeah. I think that's a common criticism that you hear McCarthy is people talk about like, well, there's no story or there's no plot. And you get like this distinction between like, what is a story? And what is a plot, right?
All the Pretty Horses starts extremely slow. Like
yeah, it does.
I would find it would be a tough sell if that's what I would encourage somebody to read Cormac for the first time. Like that would be difficult. Like I knew the story was going to go somewhere, but I almost put it down three or four times.
Yeah. Well, absolutely.
But also, Nick, you listen to it on audiobook, and I actually think listening to on audiobook is as good as the audiobooks are for these. I think it's a bit of a disservice because I think when I first read All the Pretty Horses, when I first read Cormac McCarthy, the way that the words appear on the page really drew me in. And Nick, Ian, this is something we haven't touched on. I don't know if you want to talk about it. I can later otherwise. But just like his sparse style, his lack of punctuation, I think it like was an interesting texture on the page.
Yeah. Yeah, it flows, it moves, it gallops, I guess you could say. I think if you like, you could recommend this to someone as their first McCarthy, if you could like shut them in a room and not let them out until they had read 50 pages in. And by that point, they're going to be hooked. But
this book, there are several passages about tacos.
yes. Oh my gosh. The
nothing
tacos.
Will make you want to have like a fresh tortilla taco more than some passages in this book.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with that. And I would say in general, this is another one of my reasons why you should read this book, Nick, or I guess read it again. This is completely moot because you've read both of these books.
Yeah.
This is why you should
level
return
playing
to the,
ground.
This is, it's true. This is why you should return to this book. It's so evocative. And he's not, I would say, a florid writer. He's not a writer who's like very got a lot of flourishes and stuff. it's very kind of bare bones and straightforward, but also it lets you see very specific moments, not romanticized, not dressed up, but kind of grave and great, sober and sharp-edged. The way, like, you have vivid memories that take you back to very specific moments in your life, and you're just blown away by how specific and potent they are. And he does this, whether it's the tacos or the times that they have, like, hot food after the first time in forever. I'll tell you one more reason you should read this book, and then I'll stop, okay? How about that?
Okay, how about that?
How about that? This book has a story that sneaks up on you. So we've talked about this. I mentioned this a little bit. You start reading it, and it does not seem like it's going to turn into, like,
anything.
It doesn't seem like it's going to go where it's going. It doesn't seem like it's going to turn into a galloping adventure story. But by the end of the story, you've had some rad chases. You've had revenge. Mm. You've had gunslinging. You've had knife fighting. You've had imprisonment, betrayal, passionate love, moments of just pure formidability and coolness, hilarious mistakes. This is a really funny book. You've got annoying characters who get their comeuppance.
Yeah, it's a good book.
It's a good book.
It's a good book.
It's a good book. He writes good books.
If you get nothing else from today's episode, Corm Facts McFacty writes good books.
Writes good books.
One, two, three,
Hey, are you guys okay? Guys, are you all right? Ian, Joe, are you there? I feel like I'm just on the line with a cat, you know, fan.
And a Dracula.
And a Dracula.
I'm sorry. Huh. I just had to close up the lab quick. What's up? What's going on?
Oh, we're just wondering what we should do next week for Halloween. You guys want to bring some spooky books next week?
I think there's nothing spookier than reading itself.
Okay. And you're going to bring nothing then?
Just a random book?
Anything.
He's going to bring all books. He's going to bring the concept of reading next week.
Books as a concept. No, I'll bring a spooky book. It'll freak you. It'll freeze your blood.
Whoa.
It's called body horror. Anyway, yes, I will bring a book by well-known business manager Bram Stoker called...
Bram Stoker. Yep. Stroker?
Bram Stoker is a different guy.
Is it now? Maybe you can clear this up next week. Is it Bram Stoker or Stroker?
Ian, we need to know.
I'll clear it up right now. No suspense. It is Bam Stroker.
That's my favorite porn star.
He's Bam Margera's brother from Jack Rabbit.
Because brothers famously have the same first name as one another. Nick, I have a book called The Turn of the Screw, recently adapted into a Netflix series called The Haunting of Bly Manor. It's trending, by the way, number two
in
the
U.S. as we record. I like that noise, Joe. Way to make it relevant.
Yes. Hey, I won't. Well, yeah, thanks.
thank you.
1898, Henry James, The Turn of the Screw, and Nick, it is a spooky, spooky ghost story.
Except for maybe it's not, right? Should we get into
Except
that next week?
It might not be we'll a ghost story at all. Week. We'll talk about it next week. Yeah, it's very cool.
Joseph, yes. Tell us about your book.
All right. So, Nick, I read, as you know, The Road this week. And The Road is it's this post-apocalyptic book in which a brief overview of the book, in which a father is dying. And he wants to get his son to safety or whatever like seems like safety in this horrible, dismal, hopeless world that they live in. He is there. You get the sense they're living in America, like definitely America, middle America, but it's in a place that is post-apocalyptic. And what the apocalypse event is never described. It's never discussed. Like, we get the sense that it might be a volcano, it might be an asteroid, it might be nuclear war, but we don't really know. But it doesn't really matter, because essentially the habitat where the boy and the man are living in some sort of safety is going to be no longer habitable in a very short amount of time. So this dad, as the last thing he does before he dies, wants to bring his son south and to warmer, more hospitable climates. And in order to do that, he has to walk along the road, the titular road. The fact that he's dying is like the whole reason they moved to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they were kind of living up, they were surviving where they were, like in this wherever middle America that they were surviving. And the reason that they move, the reason that they take this tremendous risk and travel the road for these months is because, like, this dad knows, hey, I'm not going to be here to protect my son. And the climate is changing quickly enough that he's not going to live here once I'm dead. So I have to get him to better climates.
So I think it's pretty obvious, but one of my favorite things about this book is that you don't know the characters. Like, yeah, you don't know their names. You don't know exactly what's going on. You don't know so many of the things that are important in a book.
Yeah.
And, like, it does a great job of, I don't know. To me, it's like a horror movie. Like, to me, it's like a really good horror movie.
You know, Ian, when he was talking about All the Pretty Horses, he used the word spare to describe the dialogue, right? Mm. And I think that is taken almost to an extreme in The Road, because here we don't know the characters' names. We don't know what the calamity was. We get their characters' backstories in just a couple of flashbacks throughout. Like, even then, not everything is filled in, right? And we get, like, this very, very spare detail. I think that the calamity is a really interesting thing, because anytime there's post-apocalyptic, I think there's something about you that wants to know what the apocalypse does. You know, you want to know how the world ended, how society ended. And when Cormac McCarthy was asked about it, he said, you know, a lot of people ask me that. I don't have an opinion. It could be anything, volcanic activity, or it could be a nuclear war. And then he says, it's not really important. The whole thing now is, what do you do? And when you say that, Nick, like, you don't know these guys' names, like, you don't know, like, the dad and the son's name. It's just the man and the boy. I think it kind of goes back to that Cormac McCarthy line. It's not really important what their names are. The whole thing that you need to know is the relationship. That's the important thing. The whole thing that you need to know is what you do.
So I'm reading a review of The Road, which refers to it as a fable. Yeah. I think that's a really interesting phrasing. It feels like there's this economy, and I haven't read the book in quite some time. But so when I was doing opposition research for this episode, I was surprised to discover it's relatively long. It's like 287 pages.
Yeah.
And that's not long, but I thought it was like 150. I thought it was super short, because it feels so tight. It feels so economical, and very much like we have these archetypal forces.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know, we've used the word spare. I think sometimes even the word sparse might be the right word here, right? Where it does feel short. It reads easily, unlike something like Blood Meridian or whatever. Like, I think the reading is actually relatively simple. The dialogue is very spare in the whole thing. And when we describe it as a fable, I think what it's talking about is, it's really Cormac McCarthy, because of course fables are these things that we can kind of recite off the tops of our heads. You know, they're these things that we grew up with. They're things that are like kind of central to our heritage or our culture. And they're very moralistic in their, you know, lesson driven. Maybe it really is this this tightrope that we walk on, I guess, between I don't want to say good and evil, because that's not quite there, but really hope and despair, right? And it's like,
would you say kind of we as readers walk a lonely road, the only road that we have ever known?
Yes.
We don't know where it goes.
Yeah, that's actually exactly what I have in my notes here, Ian.
Good.
I got the joke, Ian.
Thank you.
Thank you. So
why did you say thank you?
So, Nick, I guess a couple things that I think are interesting about this book. Nick, you read this book. You liked it?
Yes, it is good.
Yeah, thank you. Would you like to play the intro music for your Audible review?
No, we already finished that segment.
Got it. Well, yeah, but it was just Ian's book that you talked about.
No. He praised both of them. You're good.
Okay, good. So this book, when I read it too, like I thought it was unimpeachable when I read it. Like I thought it was a shattering book when I read it. I thought it was gripping. I was like hanging on every single word. I was hanging on every scene. There were moments when I was horrified. There were moments when I felt this tremendous hope. But when I started reading reviews and reading other people's insights into it, I was blown away by how divisive this book was and how many people really, really rejected it.
Yeah, there's a shocking amount of one-star reviews. I mean, what? Jesus, 40? Hold on.
Yep.
25,000 one-star reviews? Guys, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Why don't you just agree with the three of us who are clearly right?
Yes, I agree with Ian.
Yeah. Let me just give you a sampling of reviews, and then, Nick, maybe you can break one off for us. But just these are three reviews that I all saw in the same thread. The first person says, I read The Road in 2 days, in two sittings. It sucked me up and chewed me up and spat me out, exhausted. The next person said, The Road destroyed me. I've never been the same since reading it. And the third person said, I've never laughed harder at a sadder book. I haven't read it in 15 years, and I still think about it all the time.
How on earth do you laugh at this book? My goodness gracious.
Yeah, it's pretty heart-wrenching.
In the same thread, The Road might be the single most underwhelming book I've ever had the displeasure of reading. This was another review says, this was the most well-written book that I will never read again. And then finally, this person says, this book changed the way I read books, right? Like these are books like Cormac McCarthy and The Road in particular. These are books that like people, they really get into or they really bounce off. One of the things I loved about The Road is it feels like what the apocalypse is actually going to feel like.
Right.
Like
right.
It's not just gloomy, like it's horrifying. Like you won't be like shooting bullets and saying cool one-liners. Like you are going to be starving. You are going to be diarrheal. You're going to be clinging to life because your adolescent son needs you. Right?
Like every day is scratching and clawing. Yeah.
Every day. And I think that it's written, like I think McCarthy writes that in just an incredibly like compelling way, like a way that draws you in and a way that, you know, I feel like one of the appeals of this book is I keep putting myself in the book. I keep putting myself in the post-apocalypse and you
as
wonder,
the man or the kid
or as the cannibal,
as the marauders, as the cannibals. Right. Ooh, and you think, you think like, man, post-apocalypse, where am I? Who am I?
I'm dead, guys. I'm sorry. I gave up. I know I have no survival skills.
He killed himself off on page one.
I had a cough way, way long ago.
But like that is presented is not only a viable option in The Road, but maybe the best option. Like the man and the son, the entire time they carry this gun with two bullets in it. Right? Like from the page two of this book, they have this gun with two bullets and it's sort of for self-defense, but it's also not. Like it's sort of like they have two bullets in this gun.
Just say what it's for, Joe. It's clear what it's for in the book. What is the gun for?
The gun is for the man to kill his son and then kill himself should things get bad. And
yeah,
then,
this book is super fucking dark and heavy.
It's dark.
And like,
yes.
I think if somebody doesn't like it, they have all the right not to. It is one of the darkest, most depressing books I've ever read, ever.
Oh, I mean, I think it might be one of the darkest, most depressing books ever written.
If like The Walking Dead is like the fun version, this is like the real life Walking Dead.
Right. Joe, do you know, did you, I'm sure you read the incidents that incited McCarthy to write this book, right?
Yeah, I have. Well, I guess maybe I haven't read the incidents. I just, him traveling the Southwest with his like young son, right?
Right. And seeing the fires.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you want to talk about that?
No, you can go. Go ahead.
Okay. So he was in, I guess he was in Texas, and he was kind of like thinking about the future, what the world would be like. And it says, he says he imagined fires on the hill, and then it was like, well, how would I interact in that situation? And so there's an element of him imagining real world kind of proto-apocalyptic events, like a wildfire on a hill. And so I live in the American West, where we've been experiencing the worst fire season on record. Each of the last 3 years has been the new worst fire season on record.
Yeah.
Lives lost, communities destroyed, millions of acres burned to the ground. And our new normal for the months of August through now October is checking the air quality before we go outside, in order that we can breathe safely and don't hurt ourselves, and ash falling from the sky. And you don't wash your car when there's ash on your car. You don't wash it off, because water reacts with ash to make lye, which will ruin the finish of your car. Now, this seems very mundane and boring. This seems like a pretty low-level apocalypse. But I think one of the things that this book does well is it sort of takes the potential that McCarthy could see. He has kind of this future telling ability, and it takes this potential and it extrapolates, how would humans interact? What kinds of most base instincts would human beings give into? And like ash falling from the sky, which happens, poor air quality happens throughout this book.
Yeah.
That's kind of at a low level what I have been living for the last several months, and what other Westerners have been living for the last several months. It's like, this is kind of coming true very, very slowly.
Oh no. And you're going to be a father.
Yeah. So Ian is living in post-apocalyptic America. Oh my God.
Ian, you should read this book again. Kind of brush up on it. See if you can get some, some takeaways.
Yikes.
Hey, you guys ever think that you read these post-apocalyptic books, that like it kind of feels like it could be now?
Yep.
some days. Each day a little more than the last. Yeah. Ian, you had one more question.
Yeah. The question is...
Ian, a question in the back?
Yes. This is more of a comment than a question, actually.
Oh, fantastic.
So, Joe, you touched on this a little bit, but I wonder if you would talk... You've talked a lot about the bleakness, and you've talked a lot about the misery. Why?
you say
there's a tightrope with hope. A tight hope, we might say.
A tight hope.
A tight hope.
Tight hope walking in this book?
Yes. Could you please tell us, like, what are they doing? Like, how is their hope? What is the source of hope? Both maybe within the fiction of this story and for us as readers, like, how is it not just unmitigated
downer?
So I think one of the cool things about this book is at many times it feels as if it's unmitigated, just ash and oppression, right? But for all of the darkness and for all of the time that you spend in this just dismal, dismal landscape, every once in a while something happens that feels, as a reader, genuinely hopeful. There's a point, after they find these people locked in a cellar, like being locked away and eaten limb by limb, after they like see this incredibly pregnant woman and the next day find her newborn child roasted on a spit.
This is a long-winded way to get to the positive things.
Well, but there's also they find an abandoned bunker full of supplies, like a doomsday prepper's bunker, like untouched. They stumble across it, right? And when they find that, you feel that their hope is genuine. At one point, they find this elderly man just walking the road by himself. And the boy, not the man, because the man, of course, knows that you have to save your food and you have to, you can't help other people because anything we give them is something we don't eat. Right. But the boy insists on giving the man food. And the boy, through all of this, is really just this kind of I don't want to say hopeful. He's really this like beacon in this book, right? Where like his morals, his morals like guide him time and time again to do the right thing. And the man has to watch him and care for him and protect him because the boy wants to meet people. The boy wants to play with other kids that they come across in these desolate towns, right? But the man keeps the boy back and keeps him safe throughout. But the boy, like his insistence is like, they talk about the fire that the boy carries, right? And they talk about like this almost this Promethean, like this fire to mankind that the boy has in him. Not in like a biblical way, maybe not Promethean, not in like a Greek mythology way, but just like this good spirit that Let me ask you this.
Please do.
There's always this classic question in philosophy of whether or not you believe that people are basically good or basically evil, right? Basically good or basically selfish. Do you guys have a side that you fall on in that conversation?
Absolutely.
I do too. Nick, do you believe people are good or bad?
I don't believe in that question. I don't believe there's an answer. That's what I think. I don't think there's one answer.
I do believe that based on the evidence of my eyes, human beings naturally tend to be bad. And when they do good things, it is either out of self-interest or out of accident. It's accident. But I believe that human nature, the philosopher Thomas Hobbes says that human life is nasty, dull, British, and short. And I think that defines humanity for me.
I'm a little surprised to hear you say that, but I like it. My entire life, I've had this just like underlying philosophy, but this underlying belief that like people are good, like people like want to be good to one another, right? And that ultimately, like my belief is that we're all in this together, right? Nothing in this book supports that except for this boy. Like this boy who is just like this young, pure, like wants to reach out, wants to be good, wants to do the right thing. Like that's kind of the tightrope in this book, is all of these horrible things, right? Like contrasted with like this boy doing these kind things. And I don't know.
Is it true that Willie Nelson wrote the song On the Road Again about this book? And if so, how cool is that?
That is A, true, and B, awesome.
Great. Thank you. That's all, Your Honor.
On that note, thank you, Ian. The Road is the better book, in my opinion. But
you fucker.
I'd like to hear about tacos. You can win this week, but you have to end with taco quote.
Okay.
That's the rule. Find it. All right. Find your taco quote.
Okay.
Hold on. Wait a minute.
Did you find it?
Okay. I think I might have a quote here. This might be the one I'm thinking of.
Okay.
All right. Are you ready? Let me read it.
Yeah, you read it.
Get it started. Okay. Traditional Mexican beef tacos are made with marinated sliced and shredded beef on soft corn tortillas. Those are great, but that's not what most Americans think of when we think of classic tacos. Add 1 pound of 90% to 93% lean ground beef. And then it goes on like that. That was the joke.
Is this Cormac McCarthy's recipe blog?
Well, this is what he's been doing since 2006. He's just been doing full-on recipes, yeah.
We solved the mystery.
We solved
the core mystery.
Core mystery. And you can read more recipes at Mick Cormac. McFact.
Corfax McMystery.
dot com.
And that's what I call a corn fact.